This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the 3 months since a gunman killed 49 people at Pulse, the sidewalk outside the Orlando nightclub's become a site for people to mourn the lives lost and leave handmade tributes. On Monday, a smaller fence was installed around the club, and owner Barbara Poma says it leaves more room for people to visit and it should help ease congestion on that stretch of Orange Avenue. Poma explains the new fence also features a commemorative wrap with local art.
It is a collection of artwork that has been done around the city. Some are murals, some are just drawings that were collected for a children's coloring book, actually, I believe. And they've just made a big banner and have each one of them on there.
Mm-hmm. Some 3 months on from the tragedy, I'm just wondering, how are you doing, Barbara Poma?
We are still taking it day by day here in our community. We know we are very well supported and loved throughout the country and the world, and we find much comfort in that. But we're still struggling, and so, you know, we call it our two-step forward, one-step back method, and that's kind of how I know people I've met and my staff. That's how we are handling it.
And the Orange County History Center director is saying that just the sheer volume of stuff they've collected is pretty overwhelming. When you think about the amount of, you know, effort that's gone into some of these artworks, what goes through your mind?
It just shows how the whole world is uniting, and it's uniting and hopefully breaking down some barriers and walls and pulling people together to take another stand and to take a better stand and a stronger stand to create some equality and some, you know, compassion in our world.
What do you want to see here? Like, what would you like to see in the place of what we have here now, the nightclub?
That's hard to say. Like I said, we're going day by day. And we haven't gotten there. I want to see a peaceful place for people to still come together and to still heal. I want a place for the whole world and generations to come, to have a place to come visit and to know and to feel it and to help our movement, you know, keep going forward.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Before the new fence could go up, Orange County Regional History Center staff collected items that people had left in front of the club, from handmade artworks to the privacy screen itself, which people had written messages on. History Center Executive Director Michael Perkins says all of those items are being added to those collected already from other memorials around the city. How many items, how much material have you collected in the last few months, I guess?
We've frankly lost count in our process of just collecting, but we were reporting about 3,000 coming into last week, 3,000 to 3,500, and we figured that we got at least 1,500 or so last week in our collecting, so roughly 5,000 items, probably.
And anybody who's driven past the site of the Pulse nightclub or any of the memorials that were up after the shooting itself would know the kind of things you're talking about. But just give us a sense of the kinds of things you've collected up and catalogued.
It's been an amazing assortment of items, anything from signs and posters and pictures to pieces of art, to three-dimensional, really large wooden items that are just amazingly complex. We're looking at one right over there where somebody took two large wooden reels that you would put a lot of copper tubing on or something, and they've created a work of art out of that by stacking them one on top of another and then hanging small wooden boxes from them that each have a heart, a rainbow painted on them, and We believe there are 49 of them there, one for each victim of the shooting, with little messages on them. And so people have just created incredible works of art. The rainbow flag look to so many different things, including rainbow flags, of course. But you see further along here, there's a tree, an artificial tree, with the leaves all done in the rainbow colors. It's just been staggering, right down to little notes just where somebody's written something on the back of a business card. Banners, large banners from different cities around the nation, items from around the world we've collected.
How do you go about storing this stuff? What do you do with it now?
Well, we've collected everything. We do have pictures of everything. And now comes the longer part of actually the preservation process where we go through and we attempt to preserve each item. That's cleaning it, writing down the day that it was collected and any information that we have about it, taking a good image of it and putting that into our database. The cleaning alone can take anywhere from 10 minutes for a very simple item that's hard and didn't retain any water or the sun didn't really do anything to it and it isn't dirty, to a few hours or maybe even a day or two, depending upon the condition of the item. So it's a long process to really effectively clean these items for long-term preservation.
What about as far as a permanent display at the Orange County History Centre itself? Is there some thought going into what's going to happen there?
Well, we think we're a little early for that. It's 3 months in. We're ready to do what the community wants to see when the time comes. We will be ready. That's a large part of this, is the collecting and preserving of these items, is so that we are ready for the future when the community's ready to look at the event that happened here and the community's response afterward. We'll be ready to tell that story, but we've not really given any hard thought to plans as of yet for how to memorialize this event.
Have more people been paying attention to the History Center now that you're part of this process of kind of cataloging history as it happens?
It's really been interesting. We've had countless comments from people, both at our website and even just walking by us as we're out collecting, and we have been collecting at the different sites, just thanking us for the work. And I mean, it's not universal. I mean, this is still a very raw and emotional subject, and we understand that some people would want things to last forever, but at the same time, we feel like we're doing the community some good as well, just so that in 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, people can look back on this event and they'll see not just the horrific event that happened on that day, but the community's unbelievable positive response afterwards and just the way the community came together.
Michael Perkins, I'm guessing just from the number of handmade memorials that people have put up so far in the last 3 months, there'll be more, right? Even with this new fence, I'm guessing some people will want to, you know, bring some of them, some of what they would like to offer and leave it there. So does your job kind of as a curator of this stuff continue?
We will continue in some form or fashion. It's long term, I can tell you. Coincidentally, I was in Charleston in July of this year, just 13 months after the shooting at the church up there, the Baptist church up there, and indeed I stopped to visit, and there are people leaving memorial items there, and it had been 13 months. As long as this site is here, people will at least leave flowers, at least leave something, at least for the foreseeable future. At memorials, they tend to have a long life.
Did you have a chat to the folks at the whatever the equivalent of the History Center is in Charleston to figure out what they were doing, their process as far as cataloging that stuff?
We reached out to Charleston and a few other museums, and the 9/11 Museum and the Smithsonian within the first few days after Pulse happened, realizing that this was going to happen. You still aren't ready for it. Just the sheer amount, volume of items has just been so great, but we at least had a process ready to start. We knew more or less what we were up against, and we had insights from the unfortunate folks who've been through this in the past. So we at least had a good grounding in what we could expect to be up against.
And just from talking to folks who are involved in the One Orlando Fund, you know, they've said it's good to feel that you're doing something specific and helping in the aftermath of this. What's your perspective, Michael Perkins? Do you feel like it's been good to kind of help do something positive and constructive in the aftermath of this tragedy for Orlando?
Well, that's how we're trying to look at it. Is we look at this as two events. We look at it as the shooting, and then we look at it as the community's response and the world's response to the shooting. And that's what we're collecting, is we're collecting the response. And in that way, it is positive in the love and support that was given Orlando by other Orlandoans and Central Floridians and throughout the nation and throughout the world. So that's the story that we will be ready to tell in the future, is at least the community's response and the world's response to this. So in that way, we think that hopefully we're documenting it effectively now for the future, and that'll be a compelling story to tell.
Michael Perkins, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Across the street from Pulse is Innovative Electronics. We spoke to owner Jonathan Toothman about 2 months ago about how his business was doing. Since then, he says things have not improved.
Business is down. It's down substantially. I mean, actually, it's interesting because I see passers-by quite frequently. I see, you know, people over at the Pulse nightclub, you know, mourners and such, paying tribute and such on a daily, hourly basis. There isn't a time that goes by that you don't see 8, 10, 15, 20 people any given time over there. And, you know, they come and go. But my business has suffered. It's suffered substantially.
You've got a view of the nightclub here. You see things coming and going. You'll see them taking those items that people have left there away and putting up something new. You know, what goes through your mind sort of seeing the traffic of people through there?
Well, it was an incredible tragedy. I mean, incredible tragedy. I mean, 49 people killed, you know. Thankfully, the last I've heard is that all people have been released out of the hospital. You know, I mean, we reflect on that. And my business is just a, you know, it's a small issue. I mean, my business is down, really, relative to what happened across the street on that day in June. You know, it's incredible, you know, what has happened to people's lives. People lost their lives. People have their lives changed forever. You know, so I'm an electron about the nucleus here. I mean, I'm just a small, you know, factor in this whole thing. But no, my business has suffered, and, you know, I do what I try to do to try to restore things back to a normalcy.
When you walk down the street here, you see the banners flying from the light posts, and they say Orlando Strong, you know, downtown South. Have some people come into the store and say, look, I heard the call for people to support the businesses that were affected in the aftermath of Pulse, and here I am at your store kind of bringing my business here?
That direct effect was immediate and very short-lived, actually. I saw some immediate results. I met with the governor 2 days after they opened the streets back up, that Wednesday, that day. And it was a favorable meeting. He made had a press release, and there was a lot of outpouring. Very short-lived, though, for a two-day span. I was one of the founders of the Downtown South Main Street group back in 2008 and involved with the banners and such. And, you know, the identity of our district has really helped businesses overall in this corridor to try to identify with a specific location. But we all suffer from various things. And again, I have some issues concerning my business, which is not directly related to the Pulse incident. Maybe, again, the Pulse incident was the catalyst for my business struggles at this time.
Do you get the sense that this area, this little corridor here we're talking about, downtown South, will recover down the track, or are you a little bit pessimistic at this stage?
Well, you know, it was actually initially quite exciting to have heard some of the funds that they raised the Orlando One Fund that came together with in excess of $23 million. The hope was that they would have directed some funds to the district as a whole, in which they could have actually used some quite a lot of funds for issues concerning traffic calming, pedestrian friendliness, things that would have encouraged shoppers in the district, or not even shopping so much, but more of a presence, more of a sense of place for the district than what I think the intention is. You know, the Downtown South Main Street group, which has been in place since 2008, its purpose is to try to do certain things to try to create more of a sense of place here. But the funds that were raised for the purpose of Orlando One for the Pulse is gone not for that purpose.
Is there anywhere else you can turn to as far as giving this area a bit of a business boost?
Again, the Downtown South group has created a meeting that's coming up with the city of Orlando. I'll be meeting with some folks there. I'm not sure. It's a couple of weeks away still. Basically lay out on the table some of the problems that exist and to see what kind of economic stimulus might still exist other than the fundraising that's already occurred.
Jonathan Toothman, thank you so much.
Thanks, Matthew. I appreciate your thoughts.
Jonathan Toothman is the owner of Innovative Electronics, a radio shack across from the Pulse nightclub. Still to come, how simulation and modelling is shaking up medical and military training. And from caviar to cupcakes, there's no limit to the kinds of food you can get from a vending machine, but is it worth the convenience factor or just a gimmick? Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection, I'm Matthew Petty. According to the National Center for Simulation Modeling, simulation and training industries contribute nearly $5 billion to Florida and directly employ more than 27,000 Floridians. The second annual Florida Simulation Summit kicks off this Thursday at the Orange County Convention Center. Well, joining us in the studio is Wayman Armstrong. He's the founder and CEO of Engineering and Computer Simulations. Well, thanks for joining me.
You're welcome.
Also joined by Angela Albin, President and CEO of Symmetry Incorporated. Thanks for coming in, Angela.
Thank you.
So, Wayman, let me start with you. just tell me quickly, what do you do and how did you come about founding this company?
Well, first of all, it's great to be here, and I appreciate what you're doing, Matthew, for the modeling simulation industry and what it represents, not just Angela, but to the community here as far as in the economic growth. I started the company in 1997. We are leaders in advanced learning technology using video games and virtual worlds to train the warfighter, first responder, and the veteran on starting the company. Some of us are just, when it comes to being an entrepreneur, Matthew, are unemployable. I saw a need that wasn't being met for how we could use game technology to train, and that's what started us off in 1997.
Mm-hmm. What was your background? Did you come from the military?
No, I did not, but I've been a contractor working with the federal government and Department of Defense going back to the late 80s, mm-hmm. and really saw, and I'm aging myself, the proposed peace dividend that came out of the wall falling in Berlin in 89. They started looking at how we could take some technology and transfer it over from military to civilian use, and I got involved working in the modeling simulation in 1994.
So you started out thinking it would be more kind of peacetime stuff, and you're involved now in more military stuff?
You know, the idea was, in fact, when we started the company, the goal was really, as far as using games, was after Columbine, that tragedy that happened was blamed on the kids playing too many video games. And I thought there could be use for video games in helping to mitigate that happening and realize for training for the schools. And I found out something that there wasn't any money in schools, but there was in the Department of Defense. And why did Willie Sutton say he robbed banks? Because that's where the money was. Well, if you're working a modeling simulation, where do you want to go? It's to the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm. So were you a gamer? Did you play video games yourself, Wayman?
I did in my misspent youth. In fact, I had the opportunity once to meet Nolan Bushnell, who founded, was the first one. If you remember going back with Atari, he had a conference, and I walked up to him. I said, I just want to thank you for the impact you've had on my career. And he laughed. He said, you know how many times I've heard that in my life? But it was true. And now that I'm with my own kids, I have to mitigate their time on it. And mostly I just get beat at Madden football by my son.
Okay, Angela, let me turn to you. So you're the president and CEO of Symmetry Incorporated. You've got a slightly different take on the modeling and simulation, a little more hands-on, if you will. Tell me what your company is and what do you do?
We develop very realistic anatomical models that represent different parts of the body for medical training. And like Wayman, we primarily focus on the Department of Defense, who is investing a lot in advancing the way that we train medical providers across the DOD, but it also transfers into the civilian sector.
So is it your customers are primarily the Department of Defense? Or
in terms of the development that we do, yes, that is funded primarily through R&D contracts or research and development contracts from the DOD. But we do sell then our products and transition them into the civilian sector. And so we have strong relationships with local EMS organizations, mm-hmm. the City of Orlando, Orange County, City of Winter Park, and provide additional or new capabilities, new ways to train their professionals.
Angela Alban, how did you get started in the modeling and simulation business?
I grew up in Central Florida, and I went away to college wanting to be a doctor. When I returned, I did not want to be a doctor anymore and started going to graduate school at UCF and started working in parallel in the modeling and simulation industry and have been working here since 1995.
And you saw a niche for realistic anatomical models?
Well, I kind of stumbled across that opportunity, but I did see an opportunity to start changing the way that we train in the medical profession and being able to employ some of the special effects capabilities that are used in the theater or in the movie industry, mm-hmm. And being able to employ those in a more with engineering discipline applied, we're able to provide new capabilities and products that could withstand the use that the military would put them through.
So you've brought with you a very realistic simulation of a pretty badly injured arm. I mean, that thing looks like it's been through the ringer, right? It's basically a broken arm. You can see the bone there.
Right. It's called a partial amputation, and it's meant to represent what would happen in the case of an IED explosion to one of the four limbs. You could either have it entirely removed or blown off, or you could have it partially attached still. And so there's one very important skill that our warfighter has been employing since Desert Storm in the most recent engagements, and it's the application of a tourniquet. And the reason that's so important is that it's what stops the bleeding. And so that particular arm is attached to a mannequin, and it's meant to really disorient, if you will, the trainee, but still they are required to apply that tourniquet, put on the correct pressure, and stop the bleeding.
What do you mean by disorient?
Well, it's so graphic and horrific to see your friend laying next to you. You're probably disoriented from the blast yourself, but they're laying there with either their limb, removed and severely bleeding, and you have to kind of go back to what you've been trained to do and be able to apply the pressure and do it correctly and quickly.
So you're kind of shocking them with the realism of the scenario.
Mm-hmm. In that case, yes.
And I've got to say, I walked into the studio and I saw this thing and I was taken aback. I mean, this looks, not that I've ever seen anything like that in real life, but it's very realistic.
We base all of our models on, first we mentioned earlier, we do life casting of the human body. So we actually have models that we cast. And so the initial figure is very realistic because it's a complete replica of that person. And then we alter it to look like the pictures and the source material that's provided to us from the different Department of Defense entities that have that kind of data.
Mm-hmm.
And then we make it work that way as well. So in the case of that, it's pretty simple. It just has tubing that is fed through the mannequin. But we also develop part task trainers, which are parts of the body that are meant to train certain tasks. And those also have electronics in some cases that interact or allow you to interact with that body part, and it behaves as a human body would.
Well, what about the sensation? Does it feel like human skin would, as far as, you know, you're confronted with this scenario, you're trying to patch this person up, that feels like a real limb?
So we're constantly doing research in that area and how do we incorporate the most realistic feeling and touch and smell and all of this. But at the same time, it's got to be durable. It's got to be something that can be manufactured easily and can be maintained.
Mm-hmm.
So there are always trade-off analysis being done, but we are looking at the next generation of tissue, if you will. As it stands, those things that you see outside are more realistic than what currently or previously has been used.
Mm-hmm.
But they still do not – they're not exactly human tissue.
And how do you – who are your models?
Well, in my case, when we started the company, because I'm an entrepreneur as well, it was my brother. And he resembled the shape and size of a mannequin that we were trying to interoperate with or provide body parts for, if you will. And so we used him, and then we hire locally from the community different people depending on the specifications of the body size and, mm-hmm. and shape that we need.
And if you're creating a mannequin like for a face or a skull or something, do you have to be careful about the level of realism you use if you're casting from a live person?
Well, we have all of the legal documents in place to protect us from that, and we can continue to use that exact form in the case of the models that we have used. But typically we like to, just out of courtesy, alter them a little bit to make them a little bit different. But what differentiates us from, or discriminates us from the competition is the fact that we are very realistic. So if you look closely at anything, you can even see pores. And we also add freckles and things like that to make it look very realistic. So mm-hmm. we don't alter it too much.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With me in the studio, Angela Albin from Symmetry Incorporated, also joined by Wayman Armstrong from Engineering Computer Simulations. Wayman, back to you. You're kind of working more in the computer realm. I'm wondering what you're thinking as you're sort of listening to this conversation about, you know, the sort of anatomical models here. Is there kind of a level of interaction between what you do and what the likes of what Angela does?
Absolutely. Angela and I go way back, and I'm so proud of the success that she's had. You know, our focus is using video games to train. Our most widely used products are in the medical realm, not just as far as in training and theater, but also right now as far as, for example, with the new VA Simlearns Center. They had their grand opening this past week, and mm-hmm. we had half a dozen of our products that were demonstrated there where we're helping to train in using how to use crash carts, how to
Just for the listeners, what's a crash cart?
Crash cart is if you were as far as inside a facility, and it's the cart that they pull up that has all of the equipment that they're going to need to treat you. And you want to have that as far as consistent among departments or floors, but mm-hmm. sometimes it's not. So we've created a model with a game to go ahead and treat, and it'll go ahead and force consistency. So if you're moved, Matthew, from one floor to another floor, different department, it looks exactly the same, and you're not pulling out and saying, oh, where is this piece of equipment I need?
Mm-hmm.
Something very basic. But if you look, after cardiac arrest and cancer, the third leading cause of death is medical error.
Right.
So we're trying to go ahead and see what we can use as far as in simulation to go ahead and minimize that medical error. And those are some of the applications that we build. Our most well-known is a game called Tactical Combat Casualty Care. We've trained over 1 million combat medics. In Vietnam, 24% of the men died in that first hour.
Mm-hmm.
It's 5% now, body armor and better medical care. And while we're never using that first-person shooter application, what we're trying to do is get a first-person thinker where you're cognitively doing the right things in the right order to save lives.
Interesting that you're talking about the kind of techniques you're using, the technology you're using, it seems like there may be more applications for that in the civilian field now too, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely. You know, when we and that's one of the reasons when you talk about the Florida SIM Summit and we have such people involved in it like the high-tech corridor and others and the mayor going across is that right now, you know, the action's not going overseas, not that that's stopped here, but what you can do locally. And one of the applications that's come out after the Pulse tragedy with a tremendous job is how do you handle mass casualty?
Right.
So we're looking how we can now take our TC3 application and, you know, working with another local nonprofit to go ahead and to make that as a mass triage to help those healthcare providers and to be able to go that because you're never going to see that, but we saw it. So what can we do now to simulate that?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we like to say if a picture is worth 1,000 words, a simulation worth 1,000 pictures. So that's what we're trying to go ahead and do.
Now, is it a computer that you play on a regular screen or do you put on a set of virtual reality goggles? How do you get involved in this?
We can do both. First and foremost, because most people, the head mount displays have just really come up of age where you can do it. The Oculus Rift with Facebook owns last year. Now we're going to be showing at ITSICA both the Microsoft HoloLens and the new HTC Vive, which is just a tremendous. But some people don't have several $100 or $600. So it's like playing a PC game. Mm-hmm. We've got to go ahead, Matthew, and tell a compelling story that gets you to want to know that you're learning without thinking you're learning. And what's amazing is you look that we live in a digital world, but the fact is that we've got to go ahead, and it's not the instructors are teaching right now, it's games. In fact, one of our clients did her dissertation on having a professor with the instructor with PowerPoint and then said, forget about the instructor. Let's have you the PowerPoint and go to play the video game. 9 to 11% increase in knowledge retention without the instructor. That's our workforce of today and tomorrow and how we need to go ahead and reach them.
Is there still a place for traditional instruction, though?
Absolutely. But, you know, if anything, I think that we're looking behind is that's been the last thing is how we use technology. And listen, and technology is not the answer to everything. And just like what Angela and I do working together, we provide that blended approach. But you can never replace live training. But how do you capture, as far as the best lessons learned, how do you go ahead in a distributed world, give them the opportunity to experience that? And that's where I think where technology is the answer.
Wayman Armstrong, how big was your company when you started? Like, how many people did you start with?
Well, it was myself, and then our first person I hired, it was 19 years ago, and he's still with me as our chief technology officer, and we're up to 114 folks today.
Wow. Now, it's taken a while to get there, right? So when you look at a company like Angela's, which hasn't been around for quite so long, when did you start your company, Angela?
I started the company in 2009.
Okay. So what kind of advice do you have for somebody starting or, you know, fairly new to this field?
He never has any advice for them, ever.
Like, what's the – let me ask you this question first, Wayman. How difficult is it to build your company from, you know, a couple people to more than 100?
Well, if maybe you weren't making the stupid bonehead mistakes I was, it might be a lot easier. But for me, it took a while to figure out and get it right. I was so passionate, believed I made some very, I want to say, horrible mistakes in incurring a lot of credit card debt, 22 credit cards, $332,000 and other things. It took me nearly 10 years to pay all that off, but it helped provide the discipline I need to go forward. And I think, to me, it's one of the things when you look on a business, you know, a lot of people tell you what to do, and you've got to do it because you're passionate. You're not doing it for the money. And that you also, as far as when you're doing that, you've got to go ahead. Any success I've had is because other people want to see me succeed. And mm-hmm. to listen to the advice, and Angela and I go way back, and I've shared some mistakes I've made. And also, the entrepreneurial story is about two words, delayed gratification. You cannot expect to say, hey, you're going to do it now. I went several years without getting paid and invested back in the company and was incredibly persistent and more aggressive than probably I'd like to be in trying to go ahead and to find the work to keep the company growing and really keeping the people employed. And that was the number one priority for years, and it still is.
Mm-hmm. Angela, 2007, was that a difficult time to be starting something brand new?
It was 2009. And,
2009, rather.
It was not difficult for me because, number one, I live in one of the most, easiest regions, I think, in the country to start your own business. And two, I have a great friend and mentor in Wayman. He was my first client. And so that's why I was teasing about that. But I've been surrounded by so many different folks and thankfully blessed with opportunities. The Florida High Tech Corridor, what an organization that's provided me grants when I've partnered with the university, has provided me opportunities to meet other professionals throughout the corridor. And there's just a great sense of I don't know, collaboration and partnership throughout the region, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's all because of that organization as well as many others. And so, yeah, it was probably, I don't know, jumping off a cliff, if you will. But I would never turn around and do it differently.
And how big is your company now?
Right now we have 13 employees. Uh-huh. We're at about $3 million a year in revenue. We recently just got a new certification with the Small Business Administration that will hopefully help us grow. And, I mean, I'm continuing to work throughout the community to find partnerships and collaborate. And Wayman and I have collaborated back and forth where we work on different projects. And so we do try to mesh those two types of technologies together to benefit the warfighter. So, yeah.
And in the last 7 years, there's been quite a lot of technological change, right? I mean, things have advanced quite a lot. Wayman was talking about the VR headsets, the growth in those. As far as what you're doing, how hard is it to kind of keep up with the pace of change there?
What we're trying to keep up with right now is the 3D prototyping and printing, and we're actually incorporating a lot of that into our iterative design process.
What does that mean?
So it's an engineering principle, and basically you go through several iterations of a part, if you mm-hmm. will, through the design process to make sure that it's what you need from start to finish. And the 3D printers actually help a lot. We have a lower end one that we use to do some of the form, fit, and function tests and trials, but then we have a higher end one where we're actually printing some of the parts versus manufacture them either by hand or out through a vendor.
Mm-hmm. What's the advantage of having a 3D printer?
The cost. We save a lot of money, and also the speed. And in our case, the ability to do it. When you do something by hand, it's not always perfect.
Right.
Right. And that's part of what you get. Which is a benefit when we're making anatomical models, but when we're making the components underneath, they do need to be mechanically perfect, and so mm-hmm. that does help us a lot.
How long would it take you to make something like the arm you've got out there?
That arm, if you include the wait time, probably 3-4 days at the most. But really, in terms of labor, it's no more than 8 hours, I think, if that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a several step process. Once the mold is made, which we have several molds of different body parts, obviously, it's just a matter of putting in the different combinations and formulas of chemicals that we use to create that. It's silicone based, and it's got all the colors and everything inside of it. So all of that is kind of layered in,
mm-hmm.
and that's why it takes a while. But really, it doesn't take very long at all, and we can make other things in parallel.
And then when you come to the final product, do you have artists to paint it, that kind of thing?
The artists are the ones that are making – I mean, these are special effects artists, really, that make it from start to finish.
Right.
And yes, they do paint it, and they add within the layers, they add what we call intrinsic or colors inside. And then on top, they'll add the extrinsic touches, if you will, with mm-hmm. the pigments.
And is this a good place here in Central Florida with the theme park industry on our doorstep to find folks who are skilled in that business?
It is, actually. And there is one school, I believe, like a professional technical school for special effects, makeup, and artists. But September, October, November are difficult times to find some of these folks. So we try to keep a core staff.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
One, I'm picky. And, you know, it's a different level. What we're expecting them to do is not something that's really allowing them to be as creative as they're used to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about gore. It's more about science. And so
right.
It takes a special person to work for us.
Yeah. Wayman, let me just come back to the conference that's happening this week, the summit. Now, is this a place for you to find new talent? Do you kind of go into these looking for folks who might be part of your business in the future?
No, this is great. Mayor Jacobs started this last year, and the idea was that, and I'm fortunate enough to chair her Blue Ribbon Commission on Modeling Simulations, how do we look at diversifying? You know, the mission doesn't change, but the budget does. And we want to go ahead and stay not just ahead of the curve for defense, but how can we go ahead and commercialize that? So the idea for this conference is purely looking at commercial applications. It has, besides, I mentioned Florida High Tech Corridor, NCS, quite a few other sponsors when it's just Thursday all day, but you're going to see applications really focused on medical, human performance, and sports
mm-hmm.
with the growing cluster that we're getting right now as far as on USTA and Orlando City, Orlando Pride, and others to go through on that. And the idea is to show folks how it could be used, how it's not being just used in for a Florida hospital or Nemours, but how entrepreneurs and ourselves are using it, how others can go ahead and to give people ideas. Hey, maybe I could do this in education. Maybe we could go ahead Ted and Workforce, Central Florida, Florida can take an application here because the cost is coming down so much. So the idea right now is to get people thinking outside the box. How can it go ahead and work in K through 12 or any industry? Because we know so often that we're dealing with a lot of our corporate training and death by PowerPoint. They're going to go ahead and make an education that can be fun and entertaining.
Right.
So that's what the conference is about. So it's bringing a lot of different people together who do that. Got a great chair and leader who's worked very hard in this in Beverly C with Tom Baptiste, General Baptiste from NCS to make this happen. And the mayor's staff's done a great job. So we're hoping anybody's listening would come out and participate. It's all day, very inexpensive at the convention center. And we're looking, we had 400 plus as far as registered as far as end of last week. We're hoping it's going to go more.
Now, how do you see the modeling and simulation industry moving down the track, say 5-10 years? Do you see the military still being kind of the driver as far as funding it and the customer for it, or is it more? Are you looking more at civilian applications?
Oh, absolutely. I think looking more at civilian applications. You know, there's nothing we're more proud of to serve the warfighter. But also we look at the fact that hopefully we don't want to be at war and that there's nothing more than any warrior would tell you that we would love to be as far as in peace. But how we can go ahead and work and tie in with artificial intelligence, taking something esoteric that people have to be trained to know, hey, I can go ahead and use this not just in the medical profession where there's a potential nursing shortage, but also as far as in education. The way that you were taught versus I've taught has changed dramatically. Well, how our kids are being taught now, and they want to go ahead and feel part of it. And if you can use this latest head-mounted displays and technology and bring history to life, bring math to life in that, taking what's being done as far as for people who are remote, as far as don't have the capability in rural areas to make them part of it, the opportunities are limitless, and it's an incredibly exciting time to be in technology. And again, it's getting that cost down where it can reach out to both as far as somebody who's in the inner city, to higher ed.
Mm-hmm. Angela, what do you see the simulation and modeling industry developing into 5-10 years down the track?
Oh, I think definitely there, like Wayman, I agree. I think that we need to start looking at other opportunities to more effectively train, and that's not necessarily for just the Department of Defense, but in the classroom even.
Mm-hmm.
Our children are being exposed to and have so much more information available to them. And I think that we are going to struggle in turning them into critical thinkers if we don't change the way that we educate them. So I think that that's definitely an opportunity for us in the future. And just for, you know, sensory integration, integrating all of these different things into a meaningful piece of content is going to be an opportunity for us. So there's a lot of opportunity outside of the medical space. And I think that's why Wayman's company has such promise. He's done work for the oil industry and for... I think even the hotel industry, I mean, any industry, Wayman's touched it.
Mm-hmm.
Where there's a dollar, there's Wayman Armstrong.
We've tried to touch it, you know.
No, but there are so many opportunities for that kind of capability. And one of the things that we were just talking about in the lobby is what am I going to do, in the next 5 to 9 years to transform my company to be a little bit more diverse and to have more access to more markets.
And what kind of ideas did you come up with?
We're going to talk
there?
After. He's going to tell me. I was working on my business plan this weekend, and that's why we were talking about it. So it's something that I'm looking at doing. And you know, to be honest, I'm not joking. I will talk to him, maybe not today, but in the next few weeks, and many mentors and friends throughout the community to evolve where it is that I'm going to go.
Well, Angela Olbin is president and CEO of Symmetry Incorporated. Thank you so much, Angela.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Wayman Armstrong, founder and CEO of Engineering and Computer Simulations. Thank you, Wayman.
No, thank you, Matthew. I appreciate it.
Up next, the rise of the machines. Pizza at the push of a button comes to Florida. Is it just the start of a new wave of vending machine food? Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Would you eat pizza from a vending machine? A Florida-based company hopes enough people will say yes and it'll see its pizza vending machine spreading across the country. We sent Intersection intern Talia Blake to investigate.
It's not delivery. It's a vending machine. If it didn't say Pizza Touch across it, you would think it was a regular soda machine. You put your money in, select your pizza on the touchpad, and watch the animated pizza throwers count down. This vending machine has traveled a long way.
This machine actually came from Italy.
Pizza Touch spokeswoman Giselle Sandra says the inventor, Fred Santos, dreamed up the idea in Italy.
And brought to Portugal. When he brought to Portugal, he did a marketing research, and he found out that the United States is the number one consumer in pizza, vending machine, and fast food. So he was, I'm the wrong place. I need to go to the United States.
Right now, Lakeland has the only Pizza Touch machine. The company plans to expand to New York, Miami, and Texas.
We are accepting application for the locations. We have evaluate the location. The location don't pay anything. Actually, we give a commission to the location, and we are the ones who take care of the machine and supply and do everything.
The reaction from Lakeland customers have been mixed.
It's different, you know. People have different tastes. Some people would like some more sauce. Some people love the pizza the way it is. So we're still doing the research and getting some feedback.
Currently, margarita, four cheese, and mushroom pepper are the only available choices, but Giselle says that is only the start.
Those are the first flavor that we are testing. We're soon going to have the pepperon. We are negotiating with a supplier for a health pizza and gluten-free. We are starting to think about that too. We are going to do the pepperoni for sure.
Giselle says she hopes to see Pizza Touch all across the country in the next 5 years.
Talia Blake with that report. Well, joining us in the studio now, Orlando Weekly food critic Fires Kara. Thanks for coming in, Fires.
Lovely to be here, Matthew.
Well, let's talk a little bit about this trend we're seeing in vending machine foods. We're now seeing things that are a lot fancier than just your chips and soda.
Yeah, that's right. We're seeing quite the proliferation of vending machines ejecting and dispensing all kinds of comestibles other than, you know, drinks and snacks. As you mentioned, there's Sprinkles out in Disney Springs. They mm-hmm. have a popular cupcake ATM is yeah. what they're calling it, and it's dispensing all, you know, all varieties of cupcakes. There is Pizza Touch that was in the news recently. They're an Orlando company, and they have a pizza vending machine, and they have quite the ambitious plan to expand. So we'll probably be seeing more of them in the coming weeks and months.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a place out of California called Burrito Box. And they're planning on disseminating some of their burrito machines here in Orlando as well. And if you're one to pay heed to a lot of those online crowdsource reviews, they're supposed to be somewhat palatable.
Mm-hmm. Burritos are a food that would lend itself to coming out of a machine, right? You can grab it in one hand. It's pretty easy to eat.
I would think so, yeah. Yeah, very easy to eat. So I don't see why, you know, now that we have burgers, why we can't have what we were talking about off air, sliders or tacos or bao even.
Is there a machine that you can get burgers out of? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know of any that you have yet, but I don't see why one couldn't be manufactured.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all over the world, we're seeing all kinds of vending machines, and Asian countries, particularly Japan, have always been on the vanguard. They just take things to a whole new level. I think you can get a bowl of piping hot ramen from a Subway platform. You can get fruits and vegetables and dairy and eggs and draft beer. You know, you name it. There's a climate control machine in China that spews out live crabs.
What?
It's true. Yeah. And there's even 7-Elevens in Singapore, evidently. They have mashed potato vending machines.
Does it come with a little gravy dispenser as
well? I think it does, yeah. I think you can get all kinds of toppings in addition to gravy.
Mm-hmm. Oh. I want to see that in Orlando.
Yeah, I want to see a poutine machine in Orlando.
So poutine, of course, being a specialty of Canada, the mm-hmm. great frozen north, is it something that do you see poutine in vending machines in Canada?
No, but there are French fry machines in Canada. Why, and you know, now that I think about it, I believe that you can get toppings like cheese and the sort of thing, but to have a machine specifically dedicated to poutine, especially with the popularity of the dish, it seems nowadays, would be something I wouldn't mind seeing.
Mm-hmm. So what's the market for this? Because if you're talking about burritos, you're talking about pizza, these are kind of foods that are popular in, you know, dorms, like students like to eat a lot of these kinds
yeah.
of foods. Is that
yeah.
is that the market we're looking at here?
Probably. But, you know, I think this whole idea seems to run counter to the farm-to-table and slow food movements. But I think apart from the convenience factor for the weary or lazy or inebriated, there's a sort of like this Jetsons-like novelty to it all. That seems very much in keeping with the current culture and zeitgeist, if you will, and how people nowadays seem to be so absorbed and obsessed with automating their lives, be it with the various delivery service options at our disposal, or self-driving cars, or what have you.
So this is the perfect kind of intersection of technology and foodieism.
Yeah, I think so.
What are the limits, do you think, Fayazkara, of what you might be able to get out of vending machines in the future? I mean, if they're selling mashed potatoes out of a vending machine in one country, live crabs in another, what are we going to see here next? What's the next step beyond pizza?
I think the world is their oyster, and the sky's the limit. You know, I'd love to see Serbian donkey cheese, you know, spewed out of a vending machine. It's called Puel, and it's a really expensive, rare cheese. So if they can do that, then I'd be impressed.
Now, you mentioned, too, that you can get things like caviar in vending machines in certain parts of the country.
Yeah, that's right. I was in Los Angeles a week or so ago, and a friend of mine was telling me that there was a caviar dispensing machine at the mall, and evidently they stock $50,000 worth of caviar at any one time in this machine, and obviously with all that kind of with the kind of expense that's going into the product in this machine, the owners have they've built in three security cameras, and they've built this thing like a fortress as well. So it's evidently very hard to break into.
What's the attraction of getting something like out of a cupcake out of an ATM, though? I mean, is it really that much trouble to walk into a bakery and stand in line and talk to the server?
Yeah, no, it is. I think it's, again, we're talking about this whole novelty, this whole Jetsons-like novelty where, you know, you press a button and out comes some food. I think that has a lot to do with it as well, apart from, you know, the convenience factor. And, you know, there's a vending machine in Vancouver, and we were talking a little bit about this off-air as well, that dispenses cannabis. And I guess that's for the people who don't quite have the munchies yet. But I think a cupcake ATM, putting that right next to a cannabis ATM would be very smart, because you would think that one would feed the other. No pun intended.
So folks might be looking at that as a possible angle here in Florida if things go the way that legalization folks want. What about this idea, coming back to the idea of farm to table? Now, you were talking about some of the things, some of the produce you can get in vending machines in other countries, eggs, for example. Is that something we might see in the United States in the future?
Yeah, you know, I don't see why not. In Japan, they've been doing it for a while. You can get dairy, produce, eggs, as you mentioned. A lot of them, from what I've gleaned, are situated near the farms themselves, but you know, in a city like Orlando, where a lot of the farms aren't that far away, I don't see why we couldn't have a vending machine that, you know, that spewed out and dispensed eggs and dairy and produce and, you know, the sorts of things that we find at farmers markets.
What do chefs think about this? Because you've been pretty clued into what's going on in the farm-to-table movement. There is this real movement towards finely handcrafted food. Food where you know where it comes from, putting that all inside a machine, that's kind of the opposite direction, right?
It does. It seems like it is the polar opposite. But, you know, we were talking about the caviar dispensing machine, and evidently chefs that are, you know, that are looking for caviar or into caviar have visited this vending machine to get their emergency caviar rations, I guess. But as far as what the local chefs think, I think it's a little early. If we do find that we've followed Japan's lead, where we have a lot of like fresh produce and vegetables at our disposal, then I think, you know, they'd be all for that.
What are your thoughts? Would you eat a pizza out of a vending machine?
Probably not. You know, not yet. Anyway, I might just to, you know, just to try it again for the novelty. But, you know, if I want pizza, I want to eat a good pizza. Now, if it's late at night and there's no other options, something like that, I wouldn't rule it out. But I'd probably find something at home that I'd want to make more than wanting to visit a vending machine that spews out a burrito or a cupcake or a burger or whatever.
Well, Fayazkara is the food critic for the Orlando Weekly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matthew.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Talia Blake. You can find this show and previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection, or wherever you download your podcast. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.